Hi again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 27th of November. Our guest this hour has written a fascinating book, and it's going to lead to an equally fascinating conversation, I'm sure. Howard Chudikoff is the author of Children at Play, An American History. He is George Littlefield Professor of American History at Brown University and has written a number of other intriguing books, How Old Are You? Age Consciousness in American Culture, The Age of the Bachelor, Creating an American Subculture. When he was a kid, he broke the child labor laws, he said. At the age of 12, he worked 20 hours a week during school vacations in the warehouse of his Uncle Jack's business, which happened to be a toy distribution business. And he was working a lot by the age of 44. He includes some information about the games that he used to play. But with all of, as he says, the stimuli swirling around me, he decided that he would write a history of children's play in America. Play being amusing activities that have behavioral, social, intellectual, and physical rewards. And it looks at play in different ages. It looks at play among genders, play among those who have and those who have not, play among Native Americans and those who were slaves, and play in the 20th century, play. What happened to play since we got television? There's a big change. It's just a really fascinating book. And it prompted me, actually, to ask for a doll for Christmas. I must be going back to childhood, but I want a doll. A doll, you know. I wanted paper dolls, but you can't find paper dolls. And maybe you can. That would be my Christmas request. Paper dolls. What's happening? And we'll welcome phone calls. We're going to get all kinds of calls because I know that we think about this. We want our children to get smarter by use of toys. We think that maybe they're playing too many video games. It's the downfall of their intellect, et cetera. There's so much to talk about. And the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Hello, Howard. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for those very nice comments, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
What a great idea for a book. I mean, it's just an unusual idea for a book, isn't it? It sounds like all of your books fit into that category, something that people haven't thought about very much.
Well, I like to have fun research and writing as well as reading, so I thought I would try to write about things that affect people every day and look back at history and say, how did we get to where we are now? What's happened in the past?
Yeah. You know, when I look at your childhood, I don't know when you ever had time to play those scrub bat and ball games. You were a worker. You were a worker when you were just a kid.
Well, I did. But, you know, when I was growing up, I didn't have all those structured activities. I did play Little League a little bit, but I didn't have soccer league and soccer camp and computer lessons and French lessons and summer camp and play dates. And I can go on and on and on if you think about what kids do today.
Right.
And I didn't have a computer either.
Right. Do you now?
Yes, I have too many of them.
Life has changed. I love this description, and it is a form of play that fits the category of children cultivating their own underground of unstructured and self-structured play, which they don't talk about with adults, which we all have memories of. And you and your pals playing scrub, making up your own kind of bat and ball games. Most of us, I think, most of us did that when we were kids, and I think most kids still do that. Some don't, but still do. We invent our own games.
Yeah, we do. And another thing that really got me going into this topic, as I began to research children, I came across this book that was a bestseller about 50 years ago with one of the most engaging titles ever. It was called Where Did You Go Out? What Did You Do? Nothing. Now think about that title for a minute and how many times kids say that to their parents. Where did you go? Out. Mm-hmm. Well, of course they went someplace. And what did you do? Nothing. Well, of course they did something. And so what I was really interested in was to investigate children's culture, not what necessarily what adults thought they were doing or wanted them to do or imposed on them to do, but what they were doing for themselves and how that, what those changes and continuities were over time.
Mm-hmm. There is a world that we as children, who was it who said that you quote that this age group 6 to 12 is a species that hungers for freedom as it lives on reliance, but that hunger for freedom is very strong in those years.
Well, it's those are the years where play is the most significant, becomes the most significant aspect of children's own lives. You know, we children who are toddlers and early children, childhood, that's a time when we do try to get them to play and we give them things to play with. And by the time kids are adolescents, then they really do have all kinds of other things in their lives and they are looking out in different directions. But real childhood, what Freud called real childhood, is those ages 6 to 12, have been many ways overlooked by all kinds of scholars, but especially historians.
You talk about the various factors involved in play. Probably one of the largest changes has been the change in the American landscape, that the environment for play was very different in my childhood and probably your childhood than it is today. The flourishing of the suburbs, there's not much open space. There are reasons that people don't go outside because of perceived lack of safety, et cetera. But where we play now has changed quite significantly and certainly from 100 years ago.
It certainly is. We play a lot more indoors, in the home, and we play in structured spaces. You're certainly right, where 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago in the United States, children roamed the countryside, the woods, the forests, the fields, and when cities grew, there were still vacant lots to play in. But now adults have overtaken a lot of this space, not just to protect children from that space, but to get children out of the way. You know, how many times do you see kids doing things on the sidewalk or a street or an alley and think, that's not where they're supposed to be. They're in the way. They need to be somewhere else.
And tell me how that was different. Let's just do a little historical perspective on that issue. There was some of that during the industrial age, right, that parents were a little bit worried about where kids were playing. They didn't want them roaming the streets, and so they created special places for them.
Yes.
In other times and in other cultures. You point to Native American cultures where there was more independence. Children were granted more independence. They were greatly loved, but they were more independent.
Yeah, they were. I think I always have to remind myself, as well as others, that when looking at this context of play, we have to remember that for the greatest part of American history, and in fact human history, children ages 6 to 12 have worked.
Yum.
Now that means, you know, not necessarily employed, but they worked in the fields and in the home, and then eventually in the factories and then in the streets. And also, your listeners may be interested to know that for the greater part of children's lives, they do obey parents, but not always. So a lot of the changes that have occurred over time have been the kind of tension resulted from the tensions between children and adults. Now, years ago, certainly parents always were concerned about the safety of their children and guiding them towards certain goals. Those goals have shifted somewhat over the years, but the protection of children has always been preeminent. But certainly there have been different views of dangers lurking in society. If you go back 300 years ago, the danger that was lurking in society in many communities was the devil. But then by the 20th century, then there are more mechanical dangers as well as social dangers in the growing populations.
Is there a devil now in all of this, do you think?
I guess the devil is how you define it.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of the book concentrates on 20th century play. Let's just spend a few moments because it is such a huge thing that happened to play.
Sure.
And that's television. And
yes.
You pinpoint the Mickey Mouse Club.
The Mickey Mouse Club represented to me a major watershed because it was not only the first daily program that was directed at children, but it also was performed by children, with the one exception of Jimmy, the guy who overlooked all of the kids. But even more importantly, one of the show's first sponsors was a Mattel toy company. Didn't make Barbies yet or any of those toys we associate with it, but it advertised things like the Mattel Burp Gun, which was a kind of a machine that popped out ping pong balls with air pressure. Now, what was significant about that was that Mattel was advertising toys directly to children every day of the year, not just at Christmas time, but bypassing parents to create demand among children and start a trend that had not existed before. Visual representation and the attempt to affect children's tastes.
That is a huge change, isn't it?
It is a big change, yes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you think about it, before that time, parents were essentially arbiters. They were the ones who selected the toys for children. Now, I'm talking about a matter of degree here. But parents really had a say in what toys children received.
Mm-hmm.
But once television advertising begins and the media expand, then children become the selectors of toys and parents more providers.
Right.
Just providers.
There's been a big movement. Tell me when this started, and I didn't know until I was looking at your book, that many of us want our children to be smart, right? So we're looking for those kinds of toys that will make them smart people, caring people. But there's a big movement to make them smart. So we're looking at, you know, blocks, or we're looking at certain kinds of toys that will help them develop some of their motor skills, some of their intellectual skills. How big a movement has that been in the 20th century? Is it still with us?
It has and it hasn't. I think that it's the educational toy movement, which, you know, was associated with the development of Play School and Fisher-Price
right.
and those.
Which is pretty old, Play School. I didn't realize how old Play School was.
Yes, well, that's what I was going to say, that they come from the early 20th century.
Yeah.
But if you look at toys and games that existed, they weren't mass manufactured, but they certainly existed in the late 18th and early 19th century. They had a lot of educational components to them. There were playing cards and board games that had themes of geography and history and patriotism and even mathematics. So we can't really say that educational toys are really a recent phenomenon, but certainly the mass marketing of them are, and the distinction between toys that somehow have some longer range function, whether they're erector sets or kitchen sets or blocks, and the difference between those and those toys that are pure entertainment, that are attached to Mickey Mouse and Barbie and Harry Potter and Transformers and all of the rest, there's a real distinction there.
Mm-hmm. How important is play? How does it help us out as human beings?
I'm not a psychologist, but I certainly would say that play helps us to learn our own possibilities and our own limitations. And it helps children to experiment, to find out on their own, and to learn. But, of course, play, one of the biggest components of play is fun. And fun, in many ways, is non-utilitarian. But we try to make it utilitarian by imposing so many things on children that we call play, but in some ways becomes more like work.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest is the author of Children at Play, An American History. 800-486-8655. And our guest is Howard Chudikoff. He is a professor of American history at Brown University and also author of How Old Are You? Age Consciousness in American Culture and the Age of the Bachelor, Creating an American Subculture. We have one line open if you'd like to take it. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and we start with Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Catherine.
Hi.
I'll be 69 come January, but I attended a one-room country school right after World War II. And we invented our own games. Pull away, softball. When we played softball, everybody played. Played fox and goose during the winter. And we never, the teachers we had there over the 8 years I went to school there would never have let us stay inside unless the weather was extreme. And when it was, we'd go to the basement and we'd make paper airplanes. We were building the jets that they're flying today, the different types of models and different things. And then at Christmas time, before Christmas, we started making presents for our mothers and our fathers for Christmas. We were outside all of the time. Then we also played what they call King on the Mountain.
And I remember that game.
Oh, boy. Then four or five of the little kids would pile on one of the bigger kids and push them off. And that would just round and round. And we just had a lot of fun. And all we had for equipment there was what we'd call an ocean wave on a merry-go-round. We had an ocean wave, and we had a set of swings, and we very seldom used those. But mostly, sometimes we would, when we played pull away, sometimes we'd play one-hand touch or two-hand touch, and then you'd always have a disagreement whether somebody got somebody with one hand or two hands.
Yeah, exactly. Howard.
Yes. Hello?
Yes, we're here.
Oh. I think Eugene has made a very interesting comment that shows some of the major changes that have occurred, and one of those things is the amount of risk we will tolerate children to take. And it just astounds me how half of the school districts in this country have eliminated recess.
It's terrible.
And that in some areas, children are not allowed to run, to skip, to play ball on school property because of liability problems. But there are also just parents themselves. You know, how many times now do we hear parents say, don't do that, you'll hurt yourself, mm-hmm. or you'll hurt somebody else, even if it's, you know, maybe it does result in a skinned knee or a bruised finger or something like that. I mean, I don't want to minimize the fact that really awful things do happen to children from hazards that are in society, but we seem to be a lot more protective now in organizing play and in organizing all the activities of children than we were 75, 50, 100 years ago and before.
At what expense?
Well, the expense is, I think, again, that children are manipulated and by the adult world more than ever before and have to find even more subterranean ways to exert their independence. And they're not allowed to experiment and learn from their own mistakes because of a lot of this controlling behavior.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Customs, excuse me.
Thanks, Eugene, very much for the call. Ron is next from Abrams. Hi, Ron.
I just wanted to call in and tell you a few of my experiences. I'm 71. And, we used to make our own street carts out of orange crates and manufacture our own steering mechanism out of a broomstick and a piece of rope. And we made our own kites. And we lived on the north side of Appleton. We were the last house on the street. We were about four houses from the end of the street. We were the last house on the street with running water. And there were three or four houses past us where the children had to haul water from our outside faucet and milk cans year-round for all their water use in their houses. Now, if kids had to do that nowadays, it put the parents in jail for not having water for the kids.
Hmm. So,
and just, you know, on and on. I could go on and on about it, but I know you don't have a lot of time. But anyway, it's just, you know, yeah, kids are coddled nowadays. They're too structured, and they just aren't allowed to do hardly anything compared to what we used to do years ago, and so on and so forth. You know.
Howard.
Well, one of the things we probably should think about, Ron raises some very interesting points about how children really manifest their own creativity, how they have always used their imagination and their own abilities to make things for themselves. I guess we tend to think and assume that children really are coddled today, and I've been implying that quite strongly in my previous remarks. But maybe one of the things we ought to think about are what ways do children exert their imaginations, their creativity today, even though we overlook it. You know, we tend to use the models of the past and our own experiences. But if you watch children of the ages 6 to 12 today, we have to think about, are they really being dulled down? Is everything given to them, or are there ways that they are still finding to try to exert their independence, to utilize their innate creativity, and really do things with the materials that they have at hand that are very different from the materials that we had at hand in our childhoods?
And I think you still see quite a bit of that, Howard. You see children making up different kinds of games, new rules, their own. They're still doing that. They're still being inventive, I think.
I think that's very true. The electronic age has made a big difference.
Yes.
In, it's not just television. As I was implying a minute ago, toys are really part of the entertainment industry now. You walk into a big box store, a toy department, or a Toys R Us, the shelves that confront you at the very front of the store are those with the themes of Transformers, of Harry Potter, of Barbie, of Disney, everything that's related to the movies, television, books, and even the music industry. So toys are quite part of that entertainment industry, and electronics have had a lot to certainly have had a lot to do with it. But what interests me about, if people may want to talk about video games, because that certainly is now a big thing with even young children. You can't take apart a video game and use part of it to put in a toy truck or
right.
to put in a dollhouse or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make up your own rules. You have to play the rules that are established for you by the software. And I'm exaggerating, but you can't cheat like you could with a Monopoly board or with a Candyland or something like that.
Oh, we weren't cheating. We were just making up our own rules with Monopoly, right?
So we would win.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
I mean, there are flexibilities now in the newer and more sophisticated computer games that actually do force the player to come up with strategy, to make quick decisions, and to learn in ways that they could never have learned in the past. Unless you were a chess expert or something like that. But so video games have altered the style of play as well as the expanse and the place where people play. You don't have to go outside to play a video game.
The expanse is pretty phenomenal, and the technology keeps changing, about every 2 or 3 years? It amazes me.
About every 2 or 3 months, so this, I think.
So there's a new game, and it costs a whole lot of money, and the games for the system are very expensive.
Yes, they certainly are. It really has changed, and that's what I meant by the expense.
Right. And yet you also talk about, there's a picture of side-by-side play with two young girls playing video games. So they're interacting with each other.
Yeah, I think that adults tend to overlook that. They think that the video games are isolating and they're too solitary and kids get locked up in their bedrooms to do this sort of thing. But this parallel play style is very interesting, where two or three children get together. They often have their own laptops now, and they are in the same place, and they're each playing a separate game, but they're talking to each other. They're interacting. They're talking to each other about it. Or they can interact with somebody at a distance over the Internet who's playing the same game as they are. Mm-hmm. So there's more socializing going on, I think, than sometimes we assume.
Thanks, Ron, for the call. Let's go next to Joyce from Shauna, rather. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. I'm very much enjoying this program, and it's making me smile as I'm driving to Appleton. I grew up south side of Milwaukee, 15th in Cleveland, and when I think about our childhood, it was so very different. In fact, when we get together, we talk about how different we were as kids. First of all, I think one of the things that's very different is when I look at the houses, you know, they were duplexes. My aunt and uncle and my Busha lived downstairs, so I had cousins, and there were many more kids in the neighborhood. We just hung around in a gang, you know, tar bubbles in the alley. Before they cemented the creeks in the city, we used to collect the bottles for 2 cents, cash them in, go buy liver, and then try crabbing. You know, going from rock to rock over the creeks. I mean, our parents would have to literally hunt us down for meals, you know, and they'd yell out the the back door. Taking all of us, probably six or seven sisters and cousins and kids in the neighborhood, taking the bus all the way to the Braves games, transferring on National Avenue, waiting for autographs and coming home all on our own.
Oh, my.
And I think, you know, were there not the crazy people running around at that time? You know, because now you wouldn't think of allowing your kids to do that. And we had such freedom, and what it gave us was this wonderful ability to use our senses of imagination and create, you know, pounding the old roller skates on somebody's refrigerator box, cutting a hole and going down a hill with four of us in the box, riding our bikes so much that just going forward and pedaling, we would sit backwards on the handlebars and pedal backwards, or how many kids could we get on a bike? And I mean, hours and hours and, you know, four square in the alley, dodgeball, baseball, building snow forts, waiting for the light to go on at Pulaski Park there so we could all, after we did our homework in the winter, take our ice skates and skate till 9 o'clock, sledding down Suicide Hill there. And we really didn't have, when I think about it today, we must have been very, we lived very modestly, you know, that duplex for the four kids that we had in our family and our parents was probably the size of an apartment a single person would live in. But we felt so rich, so happy, such joy. And I think, you know, we had our own almost hierarchy within our, you know, gang of kids. You know, my sister was the Monopoly banker all the time. And when we got a game, an actual game from the store, a Monopoly game, I mean, we cherished it. I mean, she was always, don't bend the cards, don't bend the money.
Whoa, the memories are just tumbling out of her mind. Those are remarkable, Howard.
Yes, I'd love to hear all of these comments about people's recollections. You know, the media has had, I think, another effect on childhood especially, in that my sociologist friends tell me that the actual the incidences of child molestation, child abduction, and horrible things like that have not really changed that much over the last 100-150 years, that is, accepting what may go on in the home, which we don't know, and that's where the most cases of child abuse occur. But certainly our exposure and the publicity, our exposure to and the publicity about bad things that happen to children on the street is much more widespread and sensational now than perhaps it had ever been. Mm-hmm. Every cable channel and every news program has all of these incidents on it, and so our fears about children out on the streets and riding their bicycles someplace or riding alone on the bus have really been magnified in many ways. Now, I can't say for sure whether it's exaggerated or whether it's real, but certainly people's recollections of independent activity, unsupervised, outside, on the streets, in the alleys, and the streets, reflect another change of society. And it was very interesting to hear the caller refer all the time to we and our and all of that.
Yes.
And I almost get a sense that playgroups have changed, too. Not only have they shrunk, but also they're more serialized. There's a separate group of friends that a child may have at school, to then a different one in the soccer league,
right,
and a different one in camp,
mm-hmm,
and a different one at the YMCA or church or wherever else it is where they go for activities. And there's a continuity of the composition to some respect, but they also have different friends. There's not this kind of continuous group of neighborhood gang,
mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm
does everything together. Now, again, that's a matter of degree, because I know there are places where those groups do still exist, but we're talking about, you know, I think a quite important relative shift here.
Mm-hmm. I loved your memories, Joyce. Thank you so much. I hope you've written them down somewhere, because they're good ones. And what's happened instead for a lot of children is perhaps because of that fear, perhaps because people are working a whole lot and they're not home very much, we've brought the children inside in front of the television playing video games, and now they're fat, and they're very fat, and their life expectancy is going to be shorter than their parents.
That's a very important point. I don't blame changes in play and television the most for overweight and obese kids. That certainly has a lot to do with their diet. But certainly the reduction of physical activity, and it's not for every child, but what's kind of interesting is that now, even if you go down to third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade children, the role of sports in American society identifies elite athletes earlier and earlier, and we groom them for whatever it is, tennis, basketball, gymnastics, skating, football, whatever. And the rest of the kids may get opportunities to play, but they're really then relegated more to spectatorship. And I'm talking about what the schools do here, or even sometimes, organized clubs and leagues and things. The everybody gets a chance to play does exist, but really the emphasis is on grooming somebody for success at high school, college, or even beyond.
Right. We go to Buck from Madison. Hi, Buck.
Hey, I want to expand it to Europe and America. I think kids have a parliament, and the older ones teach the younger ones games and rhymes and things like that, and then forget about it when they get older. But encapsulate historical memory and even esoteric wisdom, possibly. For instance, Ring Around the Rosie is about the Black Death. London Bridge is falling down is medieval times. London urchins would create grottos on August 5th for the St. James of Compostela. They were ignoring the Gregorian calendar. This is a Julian calendar date and things like that. All this lore, I think, kids keep that we don't know anything about. So can you speak of this?
Very interesting topic here. One of the most common questions to ask is, how do American children differ from children of other cultures and other societies? And there's only one book that I have written so far, and that's on American history, and I don't know that much about the other cultures. But it's kind of the folklore issue. issue of this is a very interesting one, too, because some of the folklorists who have analyzed play, all the way up until the television age, said that there were certain games that had a kind of universality to them, that they stayed with children and were passed down from one generation to another, even though sometimes the environments or the playthings changed. But there were certain rhyming games and running games and things like that that were continuous. But I also have a sense that the electronic age has dulled, if not erased, some of those memories, because it really imposes a different kind of game on children. And now the children who grew up with electronics in the 60s and 70s have children in the early 20th century and who don't have those memories that even their parent that faded in their parents' generation. So there's a kind of interesting, there are a couple of societies across the country of young adults and even older adults that are trying to preserve some of these games, but it's significant that the adults are trying to preserve them because they believe that the children have lost them.
Hmm. Thanks, Buck, so much for your always interesting comments. And yet, because, it's not just because, but young people's facility with electronics is pretty amazing, and they are indeed going into a world that's very different than the world that I went into or the world you went into when we just had the beginnings of computers, et cetera. Isn't it preparing for them, today's games, bad as they may be, expensive as they may be, isn't it preparing them to function in this new century?
Well, that's what I meant earlier when I talked about how the best of these games, and frankly, you know, some of even the ones that are violent or sexist or have these other questionable qualities to them, now are becoming so sophisticated, even for eight and 9-year-olds use them, but they do induce a kind of strategy planning. And children have to, you know, they have to learn. It's not just mindless. They have to know what is ahead, what has happened in the past, how they can get by a certain barrier or whatever it is that they need to get to the next step.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, they are much more sophisticated than older people were who grew up with the simple board games where you threw a pair of dice and where you moved a piece along a board. Again, I'm oversimplifying here, but there are ways that the newer electronic games do instill in children a kind of skill that will probably be useful to them and that their forebears had to attain in another way.
Right. As for the violent games and the sexist games and the little girls playing with these very sophisticated grown-up dolls that are wearing skimpy outfits, skip all that. What's the use of all that? Why do we need it?
Yeah, we don't let kids be kids. I mean, what you're alluding to is a fascinating social trend in American society, and that's what the sociologists call age compression.
Mm-hmm.
That is where younger people want to be older and want the materials, the clothes, the toys, the music of older people, and older people want to be younger. So they want exactly the same thing. So I allude to, in the book, to an 11 or 12-year-old. What do they want? They want an iPod, an iPhone, a video
right.
player,
yeah.
a CD player, and Beyonce CDs. But a 35-year-old probably wants the same things.
Right, yeah. Let's welcome more phone calls. Our guest is the author of Children at Play, Howard Chudikoff. is our guest. He is a professor of American history at Brown University. And this looks at, well, there's a whole lot in the book. It is a chronological history of play in the United States. And it looks at, you know, how people played 200 years ago. He applies census data along with information from child rearing manuals and secondary studies. He also has used a number of children's diaries and several hundred autobiographical recollections of childhood. So it looks at all kinds of things, the way we used to play, those who had not very little in this country in years gone by and now, and how they play, how play denied to a number of young people when they worked, you know, including our guest who worked long hours when he was only 12 years old and longer hours when he was 14, what it is that play does for us. And it a lot of the text also focuses on the 20th century because, as Howard says, he believes that it's during this period that the most important and contrasting developments in the history of children's play occurred. More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is the number, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls now and to Joel. Hi, Joel.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Love the program.
Great.
First of all, I'd like to comment that my mother worked in an emergency room as a nurse, and there is no one who's more protective than my mother. And second of all, I'd like to speak of play in terms of growing up in a household of seven kids. The neighbor kid would bring over new toys, and we never played with them. We always had play that had content, but it was about getting our own resource and materials and making our own process and product, and then we always had to clean up. We used to go to a grain supplier, and we would get the old pallets and then build things out of the wood. And it was never competitive either. There was always this unity about working together, and then some of us would have the imagination and the skills, and some of us would push the broom to clean up. And the games today don't seem to have that unity in people, and the children, I should say. And also, I think a point adjacent to that is when we speak of getting more toys, that is competitive in our world. And if the guest could speak to growing up in terms of getting resource and process and product and that sort of thing.
Okay.
That's a wonderful point. I've given a number of talks and interviews in places where I've gotten the fascinating question, what do you think were the best toy? And I think people normally expect me to say, a sort of Betsy Wetsy doll or Easy Bake Oven or Play-Doh or Lincoln Logs, Legos, or something like that. But my response is, especially in the context of the question the caller asked, I think the three best toys were a ball, a stick, and a cardboard box. Now, we could add a wooden pallet or something else that other callers have mentioned. The point being that the toys that last, even when, you know, when children get a new toy, maybe they'll play for a little while, and then it goes to the bottom of the box or the back of the closet. But the toys that really provoke imagination and can be used in multiple ways are the toys that children stick with the longest. Now, ball is somewhat of a commercial toy, but it can be used in so many ways. And a stick, you know, it can be a sword, a broom, a horse, a rifle, all kinds of things. And a cardboard box, my gosh, just think of all the different kinds of uses you can make out of that. So the caller is right that today we associate toys with commercial things. I mean, yeah, and play with commercial toys. But really, the most memorable toys that children have are the ones that they fashion for themselves.
Thank you so much for the call. Joseph is next from Merrill. Hi, Joseph.
Morning.
Hi.
I'm a retired instructor of 3D design. Taught for about 25 years. And a couple of things I noticed were, one, say the last 10 years, kids were having a harder time visualizing and working out three-dimensional problems. You've got a 5-year-old that can set a VCR that we can't, and I deal with 20-year-olds that can't do things that kids did 30 years ago in grade school, dealing with three-dimensional problems. One of the other things with toys was, maybe it wasn't the toys, maybe it was when they had batteries, because kids would turn them on and watch them perform. They wouldn't work with them. And one other thing that happened with me was, I think that when I had students that were less fortunate in their financial offerings as they came to school working out problems, they would have to work with more imagination with less to come up with a solution. So they were forced to. It wasn't things that were given to them. It's kind of like if you ever read Minutes of the Lead Pencil Club by Bill Henderson. It's essays of people who use computers, but they really don't rely on them. They use them because they have to in the marketplace today. When students came into my classes, everyone got a yellow pencil and a notepad. And they were told not to use a computer and take notes and do it like that. It seemed to work. And one student came up to me once and said, "You make my head hurt." And I thought that was the idea, if we were supposed to educate them, make them think.
Howard.
Well, this is off the topic, but before we run out of time, I want to advise you, Kathleen, that my research included some fascinating sources that come from the Doll Oral History Project, where women were remembering how they played with dolls in the early 20th century.
Huh.
And paper dolls really had a much higher popularity than I thought they would have. And you're right that maybe you can't get paper dolls today, except that now that there are different websites where you can go to, or a young child can go to, and find a paper doll body, and then a big wardrobe of clothes
that you can drag over. You've made my day,
them.
Howard. Oh, Howard, really?
Yeah, there's one called, there are several, but the one that comes to mind first is called PaperDollHeaven.com.
Paper doll
heaven. Write that one down.
I will,
mainly celebrity doll bodies, male and female, and even, I think, dogs. And
you
can
dogs!
Go to a wardrobe and then drag over clothes and dress them in all different kinds of ways. So I just wanted to make sure that you could restore some of your childhood.
Thank you.
And have that kind of fun.
Oh, thanks so much. You made my holidays. Yes, that's terrific.
And they're free.
And they're free, too. Oh, that's great. Thanks for the call. Paul is next from Slinger. Hi, Paul.
Howdy. I came in on this late, but, man, just finding this absolutely intriguing. You know, with the games we used to play, you really developed real-world, real-time analytical skills. You developed your interpersonal skills with other human beings, and you developed your senses and your nerve system with and muscle coordination. And today, these games are you're sitting on a chair. In many instances, I'm thinking when I was a child, I my friends and I, we used to ride the dumbwaiter at this parish that we were in, up to two floors, and it would be totally black in there. You have to open up the door when you reach a different level. And we used to go up about 10 feet in the air when we ring the bells of the church. We'd go up there with a couple of for a service, and three or four of us would be. After when you pull the bells, the fellows would pull the bell, and the kids would go up about 10 feet and then come down as the huge bells would swing. And this parish where I was used to have bowling alleys, and they were manually set. So we would go, three or four of us would go back there and watch these balls impact the maple pins, and it was just amazing, the collision, and how these things would fly up back there.
Hmm.
It I think you developed some senses of your of risk aversion, or you developed your sense of how far you should tread on thin ice, which I don't think today perhaps children develop that skill.
Howard, we have about 30 seconds.
Well, let me just read you one quick thing. When we think that children don't have imaginations today, just listen to this one little passage from a woman remembering her television set. She said, the television was on, and we could see all the lights on in the back. I remember the structure. There were big tubes in the left and big tubes on the right, these tiny tubes in the middle. So we took the cardboard off and put our dolls in there and played that it was the city of Manhattan. It was our own child's dollhouse. Now, what adult would ever think of that? And what adult would see that and say to those kids, you're not supposed to use a television for that.
Right.
But here they are using their imagination.
Oh, it's a great story.
A continuity of children playing and children using their imagination.
Yeah, what a great book. And thanks so much, Howard, for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you
so much, Kathleen.
Yeah, thanks. Howard Chudacoff, and you spell his last name C-H-U-D-A-C-O-F-F. The book is Children at Play, An American History, just published by New York University Press. That was a fun hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks for calling and listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.